We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the Seahawks Man-to-Man Podcast, powered by The Athletic. Shout out to the company. My name is Michael Sean Dugar. I'm here with my co-host, Christopher Kidd. Make sure you follow us both up on the tweet machine. You guys know where to follow me. I'm verified and all that good stuff. Chris, talk to him.
What is up, everybody? It's your boy, Christopher Kidd. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at CKIDD206, and that's CKID206.
And we're back with another midweek episode as we prepare for the Seahawks to host the New York Giants. Chris and I don't follow the Giants that closely, so we called someone who does. We have the homie Dan Duggan, who covers the Giants for The Athletic. Dan, what up, man? How's it going?
Doing good. How about yourself?
You know, I'm doing all right. You know, team's winning. That's good. You're covering a first-place team, aren't you, technically?
Yeah, that's pretty wild. If they were in the NFC West, it'd be like four games out. First place over here.
You know, before we get into the on-field stuff, you know, we've been starting every, you know, episode where we have the opposing team beat writer on the show. Just been getting into just the social justice aspect of every team. You know, every team's different, where they had voting initiatives or just had really vocal players, where they're protesting. I think the Cardinals are all staying in for the anthem. Just a wide range of things. Like going from all the way to like May to maybe the start of the season here. Just kind of what did you learn about the Giants in that regard? What did you see? Was there any noteworthy players who were especially vocal?
Well, Saquon Barkley and Sterling Shepard appeared in that big video that I think Michael Thomas coordinated. So that was, you know, they were kind of at the forefront there. Beyond that, no player has been particularly outspoken. I mean, I think they've actually really tried to have a sort of a unified type message where they're not kind of putting stuff out individually, that they, you know, at that point in training camp where everyone was kind of canceling practices or whatnot, they didn't cancel their practices, but they basically spent their days, you know, more talking social justice issues instead of, you know, watching practice film or whatever kind of mundane task would have been going on those days. But, you know, I think Joe Judge, as a first-year coach, did a pretty good job of sort of letting his players sort of dictate how they were going to respond. You know, he involved other leaders. And actually, the reason why they didn't cancel practice, which was kind of noble in its own lane, I mean, there's no right or wrong way to handle these things, was guys just feeling like with a condensed training camp, you know, I think there was actually just a scrimmage that day when everything really popped off, and they were like, well, that would really be kind of hurting the chances of young guys who, you know, aren't getting preseason games, getting limited practices. So that was why they went against canceled practices, which a lot of teams did. And then just overall, they did a whole initiative that really started in the spring. They called their team of teams. I think there's like nine teams where guys were able to choose, you know, whatever cause kind of was closest to them, whether it's, you know, community policing or homelessness or, you know, hunger, just, you know, a multitude of sort of factors that, you know, people are dealing with in society all throughout this area. And guys are just kind of doing work with that, you know, obviously all virtually for the most part. But, you know, trying to help out that way. And that's kind of been coordinated through the team. And I think guys have, you know, gone above and beyond. But so they've kind of had like a sort of a holistic approach. They're not, they haven't just focused on one thing. They're really just trying to do as much as they can to, you know, make a difference, to use a cliche.
Was there anything from, you know, levels higher than Joe at the ownership level or general manager level? I know a lot of players really active about, like, hey, you guys got the resources and the influence. We need your help.
Not that I could think of. Certainly not, like, you know, general manager level. I mean, I'm trying to think ownership. I don't recall. I mean, I think, I think John Mara and Steve Tisch were involved in some of those discussions that were going on. And John Mara is a very, like, hands-on owner, so I know he certainly probably played a role, but there wasn't any, you know, calling out of him. Maybe it's because he isn't, you know, sort of like an absentee owner. He is here, so guys, you know, they know more than, you know, than I know what was going on behind the scenes. Maybe he was more involved than even that I'm aware of, but there was no situation where, you know, guys felt like ownership wasn't doing anything. I think that, from what I could tell, you know, they seemed satisfied with, you know, ownership's involvement.
I want to get into Joe Judge a little bit, actually a lot of bit, depending on how much time we have, because I honestly had no idea who Joe Judge was when they hired Joe Judge. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's just a
join the club.
Yeah, I was like, okay, hired a guy, all right, good luck. And then I started to see, like, a lot of your reports in training camp with just, like, the little things where I was like, oh, this isn't gonna work. You got the taping the tennis balls to the DB's hands, you know, teach them not to hold, that not putting the names on the back of the. On the jerseys during camp. I think it was your report. I saw that he was making coaches run laps as well when they screwed up, man. Like, what in the world was going through Joe Judge's mind, like, all training camp?
Well, it's funny. I mean, a lot of those things you mentioned, they came off as, like, so different and unique. And, you know, I certainly hadn't seen him here. This is my fifth year on the beat. And, you know, Pat Sherman, Ben McAdoo certainly wouldn't qualify as, like, outside-the-box thinkers. But a lot of it, not surprisingly, originated in New England. You know, Belichick one year, I think, in OTAs didn't even have numbers on the jerseys. So that's certainly something he took out of his book. You know, the tennis ball things, that was just, he got creative. I guess there was too much holding going on in the secondary. And, you know, obviously you can't hold if you can't make a fist and close your hand. So, it was definitely a lot of noise. I mean, it was funny because he's, you know, a pretty no-nonsense guy, not a, like, a big personality. Although, if you get to know him, he does it more than maybe it comes across. So for him to be, like, bandied about on, like, you know, the big talk shows and all those, you know, debate shows, it was kind of funny because that's really not, you know, how he carries himself and how I don't think he was, you know, dying to be, you know, in Skip Bayless's crosshairs or anything like that, but that's sort of how it played out. But I think that it definitely could have gone, you know, sideways. And, you know, like a lot of former players or people outside said, oh, yeah, players aren't gonna respond to this. And then you start 0-5. You know, you think if ever guys were going to jump ship, that was the opportunity. But one way or another, he really kept guys, you know, on board and bought in. And, you know, we're seeing sort of the results of that. Because, like I said, they started 0-5, and now they're 4-7. So, you know, there's definitely been some progress. I think the key he has is, you know, a lot of those New England guys have the, you know, try to be Belichick thing, and from afar maybe it seemed like that, but I do think he's, you know, genuinely being his own guy. I mean, he's obviously borrowing a lot of Belichick's principles, but his personality is far different than Belichick, at least from what I know of Belichick. I think he does do a pretty good job connecting with players. I mean, he's strict, and there's a big emphasis on discipline, but he also, you know, is a good guy and lets, you know, a guy go home if he's a family situation. Just like little stuff like that that I think players appreciate. So I think that's helped, you know, kind of facilitate the buy-in despite having sort of such a strict structure.
So what was up with the coaches having to take these trots around the field after they screwed up? Like, what was going on there?
Well, see, that one kind of got blown out of proportion. If a player made a mistake, like a fumbled snap or a false start, the player had to run a lap. Now, I don't exactly remember the circumstances. They were on the other end of the field, and you know, I don't know how it is in Seattle, but we're pretty far away nowadays, especially with COVID. And I think the offense made a screwed up like twice in a row, like some sort of pre-snap thing or ran the wrong play, whatever it was. And so then like the whole offense had to run, or maybe it was the defense. I honestly can't remember. And the coaches from that side of the ball ran as well. It wasn't like Judge was like, you know, Brett Bielema, like, get on the line.
Okay.
I think they just did it sort of as a sign of unity. Like, listen, you know, we all screwed up. So we'll all kind of, it's not like every time that, you know, there's a penalty, the DC has to run a lap or something like that. It was really a one-time deal, and certainly, you know, blew up. You know, you heard about it in Seattle, but that really wasn't as big a deal as it was made out to be. And the players, they did. Every time, you know, they'd make a sort of a mental mistake, they would have to run, but not the coaches.
Wow, it sounds as if he watched a lot of Remember the Titans based on the fact that he's making, you drop a pass, you ran a mile, so he just made them run a lap pretty much?
Yeah, and it's a slow jog. I think it's more, just the idea. His whole thing is, in games, there's consequences. If you commit a penalty, there's 5-10 yards. In practice, you false start, your penalty is you got to miss some reps and jog a lap. But yeah, it really wasn't as intense as it sort of probably came across. I mean, it's the same thing they do in New England, and no one questioned it up there. A new guy coming in here, it raised some eyebrows, but we're not at practice anymore. I assume they're still running laps, but I haven't really heard too much complaining about it.
So the players really didn't complain about it. You just mentioned that. Okay, well, that sounds like he got his point across. I just looked up an interesting stat about the Giants and penalties and holding, and they're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's like anything. If you try something and it works, then players are going to buy in. And I think one thing to kind of put a bow on that is there's a lot of young players on this team and a lot of guys who either had previous relationship with Judge or Patrick Graham or guys and staff. So they brought in veterans who kind of knew the deal from the New England ways. And then you got guys who are coming from college programs and I'm sure playing for Nick Saban and Kirby Smart and all those types of coaches. This is probably like a picnic compared to that. So like guys were used to this type of coaching. And then I'll tell you right now, the first guy, if I was to identify who might have been a problem, was Golden Tate. And sure enough, he's the guy who ended up in Joe Judge's doghouse pretty early in the season, griping about his role, griping about touches. And that's the kind of guy you would think it could happen because he's been around forever. He's like, this is not how we did it when we were in the Super Bowls. This is stupid, whatever. And it came to a head, but Judge handled it. Tate basically got a one-game suspension and then came back like nothing ever happened and didn't rock the boat and is back to, being the number three receiver. But that's the type of guy that you kind of knew it would probably be a problem, a veteran who's established, but the benefit for Judge trying to put this program in is he's got so many young guys and so many guys who are already kind of bought in because of sort of a previous connection to him and the staff.
When I seen the coaches running laps thing, I had a feeling there was some more context there, but it was just really funny to laugh at the Giants at the time.
from
afar. I was exchanging, what was I talking to somebody on Twitter, and I was like, man, we're about to learn if Joe Judge can fight this year. And what do you know? I know that it didn't end up being real, but it was when I seen the report of what's the O-line coach that the report was that they got in a fist fight? Who's that dude's name?
Oh, yeah, Mark Colombo. And yeah, and again, that was another one that really, took on some legs. And listen, that from everything I've heard, that was a very heated exchange. And it's, it's big guys. I mean, Joe Judge is not a small guy. I mean, he played college football at Mississippi State. He's probably, 6'2", and, in the 200 pounds somewhere. But Mark Colombo is 6'8". And probably around 300 pounds. This guy played offensive tackle in the NFL for a long time, and he still looks like he could play. So those guys getting heated is certainly going to be a pretty volatile situation. But, I also think, the report was that Colombo, got the better of him. And we spoke to Judge the next morning on Zoom, and, either he had a really good makeup artist or, it really proves that report was false because, again, if a 6'8", 300-pound former NFL player is landing blows on a guy, I think something would show up and Judge didn't look any worse for the wear. But no, that was a big dramatic thing. And, they put the Bengals, but it didn't seem to affect them on Sunday. They kind of just kept it rolling. I don't want to act like Joe Judge has it all figured out. They're 4-7 and they beat, Washington twice, a Philly team that's, totally spiraling in Cincy, but it just, the vibe feels a lot different than it could be, especially when you think about, where the outside perception was in the summer. It hasn't gone off the rails by any stretch.
Chris just showed me a picture of the O-line coach, well, at least former now. I was like, oh, man, yeah. There's like three dudes in general, I would assume, that on an NFL staff, you probably just don't want to fight, right? It's the strength and conditioning coach. Like that usually just don't want smoke with that dude. Probably with a D-line coach as well because he's probably a former D-lineman. And then the O-line coach, especially if he is, like in this case, a former O-lineman. You just don't want beef with any of those three. So, yeah, when I seen that, I was like, oh, man, yeah. If he got in a fist fight, that'd have been – That'd have been hilarious. Dan, I'm gonna ask you my favorite question that I ask every opposing team beat writer when they come on the show. Is Daniel Jones good?
He's probably asking for a short answer, but I don't have one. It's hard to say. That's the question we're all really trying to get the answer to this season. I think his rookie year, there was definitely some promise. I mean, and obviously grading rookies on a curve. His big issue was fumbles. But throwing the ball, he had some really big games, 300 yards, 4 touchdowns. There was a lot to like. Obviously, they didn't win a lot. They weren't a very good team. So you came into year two thinking, like, this is a time when a lot of guys, make the quote-unquote leap. and definitely haven't seen that. You know, the one thing that's funny, he's actually kind of curtailed the fumbles, but he's not producing, you know, as a passer anywhere near what he did last year. I mean, I think he only has 8 touchdown passes through 11 games. I mean, I saw someone today, Dak Prescott still has more touchdown passes than Daniel Jones.
Oh, my God.
yeah, so that kind of tells you how, you know, sort of weak this passing attack has been. He played better recently. He hadn't had a turnover in his last 3 games, but unfortunately that little momentum hit a speed bump because he injured his hamstring in the second half against Cincinnati, and very likely he's going to be out this week. So now we're talking a situation where maybe he's back the next week, and is he going to be dealing with the hamstring? I think it's going to be hard to really get that answer. I mean, I will say this. I think the Giants believe in him, you know, maybe more than the outside world. I don't think there's any chance that, you know, they take a quarterback again. You know, they took him 2 years ago. I think if they went belly up this year and had a chance to get like Trevor Lawrence or we're going to have the number 2 pick, I think it's a serious discussion. But the fact that they've strung enough wins together here where they're probably, worst case scenario, going to be picking like 6th or 8th, I don't think they're going to be trying to get like the 3rd or 4th best quarterback in this class. So I think Jones gets another year, but I think you would have hoped going into year 3 to know a little bit more of what he is, and I don't see how you could have a definitive feeling like, yes, this is a definite franchise quarterback. And he's also definitely not like a stiff who can't play. Like, he's somewhere in that wide middle ground, and just, you know, kind of where he falls in that spectrum is still very much to be determined. So long answer to a short question.
What was your favorite reaction or meme after he fell on his face on primetime on that long run?
Oh, my. Yeah, that was something. I mean, I think the first one that comes to my mind was just the obvious one, was just like someone put like a sniper scope on him, you know, just like, I mean, there was some good ones. I also think back, but that one was just kind of, it just what it looked like. It's like, how else do you explain, you know, guys running free and then just totally wiped out like that? That was something.
I know you mentioned Daniel probably won't play against Seattle. So before we jump to Colt, I got one more Daniel Jones question. What do you think, like, if he comes back next year, they're like, all right, well, cool, we're all in. We're not going to take a quarterback. Let's say they invest in something, a receiver, old lineman or something instead in the first round. What do you think ultimately is like a Daniel Jones ceiling? Like, how good could he be if he reaches the potential the people in the Giants building think he has?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know, but within the building, I would say, like, what I even go back to the draft and what I saw more from his rookie year, I think like Matt Ryan is probably reasonable. And like, I don't know how people would look at that. Cause I mean, Matt Ryan was an MVP and made a Super Bowl. Otherwise, it's just been like a good quarterback, but never would be like considered other than the MVP year. Really, I don't think, you know, top 3 or top 5. Like, I feel pretty confident saying Daniel Jones is never going to be like in Patrick Mahomes' stratosphere. But then is he more like Andy Dalton, or is he more like Matt Ryan? You know, is he Alex Smith, which is maybe somewhere in the middle? That's the part I don't really know. You know, he hasn't won a lot of games, but he feels like a guy that, you know, is like capable of being like an 8-8 quarterback. Is he capable of being a 11-5, 12-4 guy? That's the part we haven't seen. Obviously, like, you know, you said, you know, what they do in the draft. I mean, they have to keep building this roster. It's you know, they really don't have a very strong roster. Even to have 4 wins is probably more than people might have expected just based on what this team looks like on paper. But yeah, so I would say ceiling, I think Matt Ryan, and I don't know how, even again, I don't know how that's viewed. I think that's a pretty good ceiling, but it's not like, oh man, you have your franchise guy and you're going to be competing for Super Bowls every year. I don't see him having that high of a ceiling.
When you look at some of these games that the Giants have lost, I mean, week 1, they lose to a talented Pittsburgh team who is still undefeated by 10, lose at Chicago by 4, you get dusted by the Niners. When you look at this team and how they lose games, I know the cliche of wording is always, hey, we were close, but it doesn't really matter. We still lost. What are some positives you can actually take from these games that where they played, it looks like they played pretty well on paper?
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, no, I mean, that San Francisco game felt like, oh boy, because like San Francisco was decimated with injuries. They had like Bosa and Jimmy Garoppolo and Kittle, on and on and on. All those guys got hurt the week before. Richard Sherman didn't play. Like, there was so many guys out, and they came in here and just blew them out of the building. So you said, like, oh boy, like, you know, this team is in trouble. And then I'm trying to remember the order. I think week four, they went out to L.A. You thought they were going to get absolutely smoked by the Rams, and they played them 17-9. Like, the offense was really struggling early in the year, but this defense is, other than that San Francisco game, has been legit and has kept them in every game. I mean, and the offense, again, has not been great. It's starting to make some strides. I mean, you know, most games are in like the low 20s. It's not like they're putting up a lot of points at any point, but the defense isn't giving up, you know, 36, whatever they gave in that San Francisco game. They're allowing the team to be competitive. And as you mentioned, all the close games. Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the loser's lament. Like, oh, look how many close games we had. No one ever says, look how many close wins we had, because you could easily look at the Giants' schedule. Every game they've won, except for the second Philly game, was a close game. They're just in a lot of close games. And I think that is really a testament to the coaching staff that, you know, the game plan-wise, they always seem to find a way to limit an opponent's, you know, what they do best. They manage to hide some of their biggest weaknesses. Now, that'll be put to the test with Seattle's passing attack, because – I don't think that's a great mix for the Giants. I'll be very interested to see what they do, how they try and defend them. But week in and week out, they have done a good job of coming up with a plan to at least, you know, make games competitive. And then what they've done recently is found a way to pull these out. But again, that I think is probably more level of competition. It's going to step up here. So even if they can keep it close against Seattle, it'll be a whole another ball game to actually, you know, beat Seattle, and especially without Daniel Jones. I think it's quite a long shot. But I think that's the thing that, you know, we saw them play a lot of close games against better teams. Now they're winning close games against, you know, teams that are around their same level. Now the question is, can they find a way to win close games against good teams? And that's what we'll really find out. They have a tough stretch here coming up, so I think it's going to be pretty revealing. That's why it'd be nice if Jones came back. I think we're just helping the evaluation of him to see how he does in quote-unquote big games, here in December.
You guys did lose a huge focal point of your offense in Saquon Barkley week two against Chicago and that loss there. How has Daniel Jones, I guess, weathered the weapons that he has and try to go out there and compete? I mean, you did mention they beat teams that are around their same level, but now they have an ultimate test going up against the Seahawks this coming Sunday, then Arizona, and the list goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, no one really talks about Saquon that much anymore. And I don't mean that as, like, a slight or anything. It's just, like, that's how the nature of the NFL is. You kind of just move on. But if you do step back once in a while, it's like, I mean, this whole offense was basically built around him. You take him out the second quarter of week two, that's a pretty big blow to get dealt. But, again, no one cares. No one feels bad for the NFL and his injuries every week. And, you know, this year with COVID, there's even more kind of complications. But that was definitely a big blow. I mean, their weapons are – you know, all, I would say a lot of complimentary pieces. They don't really have, like, you know, an alpha guy like a DK Metcalf. I mean, like, Sterling Shepard is a very solid number two guy. Darius Slayton would be probably a solid number two guy. Like, he can make some big plays, and then he disappears for long stretches. Evan Engram is super up and down. Like, he'll make some great plays, and then he'll make a couple boneheaded plays. And that's just sort of been the story of his career. So without Saquon, they totally lack that game-breaking presence. But I will say, their run game has been surprisingly effective. It all kind of goes together where they just sort of hit their stride, so to speak, around week five, where, you know, again, they haven't become like a juggernaut, but they figured out what this group can do. The offensive line has a lot of young players and new pieces. They're starting to gel. Wayne Gallman, who's sort of just always been in Saquon's shadow, has really made the most of his opportunities. He's a guy who's not going to go 80 yards to the house like Saquon, but he's actually a little bit better in terms of, like, every time he touches the ball, he's getting 3 or 4 yards, whereas Saquon, you know, had a little Barry Sanders where it'd be like -2, -2, 68, you know, like, Gallman's a little more like 6, 6, 4, and it's just consistently moving the chains. You know, obviously, both styles have their pros and cons, and you've certain Giants would certainly welcome Saquon back. But they have been able to find at least a functional run game between Gallman and between the offensive line making strides.
You did mention a guy that I wanted to bring up in Evan Engram. You guys drafted him 17th overall in the first round in 2017, and you called it bonehead plays. Is there anything else to add to why he hasn't been this dynamic tight end that they thought they were getting?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like he was obviously drafted as a receiving threat. Like, he's not a very good blocker, and he tried. I mean, he's just basically like a big slot receiver. He's just not built to be an inline guy. So that's another thing I think this coaching staff, you know, they're the third different coaching staff who's tried to make him be an inline guy, and it just doesn't work. They at least figure that out quicker than some of the other staffs and have done less of that. He basically plays a lot of just, like, detached tight end, where he's almost, like I said, like a big slot receiver. And Bonehead might be a little rough. I'm really thinking Bonehead because he just had a bad fumble last week against Cincinnati where, like, he was, like, kind of, like, army crawling trying to get a yard and it got punched out of his hand. It was just, like, you know, kind of wasn't much to gain for what he was trying to do. And he had a huge drop Thursday night game at Philly where if he catches it, it was, like, 2 minutes left, would ice the game. Ball goes through his hands. That was a third down. They end up losing that game, you know, at the last minute. So he just seemed to, like, have big spots where he doesn't deliver. It's like a disproportionate amount of Daniel Jones' interceptions have been on passes intended for Engram, and it's not even to say that it's his fault. It just feels like kind of trouble finds him in a way. But then he'll make, you know, he had two great deep balls against Cincinnati. So he's a guy you kind of have to live with the bad and hope the good outweighs it. And those scales have been like a little too even. They need that good scale to start tipping up a little bit more. But he is a dynamic, you know, piece of this offense. They don't have a lot of dynamic pieces, so they kind of have no choice but to live with it for now.
On a scale of like one to we're screwed, how are the Giants feeling about starting Colt McCoy on Sunday?
Well, I mean, they're all, you know, saying the right things publicly. I would think they're pretty high on the screwed scale, if you ask me. from what we've seen of Colt McCoy's career and what I saw when he came in on Sunday. I mean, granted, Sunday's a tough spot. You're coming into a game where he hasn't taken a snap in a game all season. You know, you throw him in cold. It's a little tough, but it just felt like they got really conservative. You know, he doesn't have a really strong arm, so they certainly weren't going to take any shots. It was a close game at that point. They were just basically trying to get out of there with a win, I felt like. So maybe they open it up a little bit, but I don't see him as a guy who's going to be, you know, spraying the ball all over the field. You know, as much as Jones was kind of inconsistent, I mean, talk about ceilings. I mean, his is, you know, much higher than Colt McCoy's. I mean, Colt McCoy is what he is. I mean, he's kind of like this gritty, like, savvy backup you want that you can put in and survive a game like Cincinnati. He's not a guy you want to start 2 or 3 games here, which, you know, we don't know how long Jones will be out for, but that could be the outcome, and I don't think that would go really well. I mean, again, you just look at his track record. He's just not a super talented guy who can just go out and, you know, defeat NFL defenses. He has never proven that. No reason to think all of a sudden here in, like, year 11, something's going to magically click. So I think they'll be sort of similar to what they did against Cincinnati when he came in and just try to have him manage the game. You know, don't make any killer turnovers. Hope the defense can let him stick around. I think that's a taller task when you're talking about Seattle versus Cincinnati without Joe Burrow. But I think that's their only path to victory. I don't think they can come out and say, you know what, screw it, we're going to sling it with Colt McCoy. I don't think that'll turn out well.
No, you don't think with the gritty vet they come out here and try to light up the Seahawks D?
Yeah, I don't think that would go real well.
No, I mean, God bless if that's the plan. I'm not going to lie. I was watching because, you know, the Seahawks didn't play Sunday. So, like, okay, let me check around the league, see what's going on here. And at one point, I was checking box scores, and I was like, M. Glennon, C. McCoy. What the hell? What year is it? It's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had Colt McCoy and Brandon Allen squaring off in a game that had playoff implications. So that tells you something about the state of quarterbacks right now with once Jones and Burrow were injured. It was a pretty grim matchup in the second half on Sunday.
Yeah, I was like, oh, what's going on here? I was like, why is Colt McCoy here in my NFL Jesus box scores thing? Golden Tate's a name people remember around here. I think this will be a second time playing the Seahawks, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm curious about how you mentioned him getting in the doghouse, because he's basically like, I'm an old dude. I ain't with all this, you know, you tape this stuff you on, Joe. But you said he got out of the doghouse. Like, how has that been for Golden Tate this year?
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Yeah, I mean, he was understandably upset because, you know, they really... He's the third receiver. Slayton and Shepard, you know, are the two starters, and then Tate's the slot guy. So if they run two tight ends, Tate doesn't play. And even when Shepard missed four or five games with turf toe, they were playing other guys over Tate because, again, they just don't play him outside, which is, you know, understandable. He's a slot guy. But I think it has to be hard for him to see, like, the likes of C.J. Board and Damian Ratley playing more snaps than him. So that just built and built and built. And then, you know, he had the Monday night game against Tampa Bay where he caught a pass and yelled to the camera, like, throw me the damn ball. And then he yelled it toward the sideline. He made a big touchdown catch late in the game. And it was funny because it was like every time they did throw him the ball, he did make big plays. And it's funny, I don't think he could get open if you or I were covering him, but it doesn't matter because he catches it. Like, the guys are always draped all over him. Can't get any separation, but he makes big catches. So I understood his frustration to that extent. He didn't really handle it that great. But, yeah, so he had the sort of one-game suspension. They didn't bring him on the trip to Washington. And then he spoke the next week and, you know, sounded all the right messages. You know, was contrite, took the blame for, you know, sort of his actions. And it was seemingly it was water under the bridge. And I don't think he's going to be back next year. I'm sure he has a big cap hit. I'm sure they're going to move on. And I don't think he'll be upset by that to leave Joe Judge in his rear view. But, you know, he's a professional. I think he realizes – he needs to produce, because if and when he does get cut, he's going to want to be attractive to another team. You know, he's planning to hang him up anytime soon. So it's in his best interest to kind of keep his mouth shut and play. And he's definitely done that. I mean, he's not what he once was. I mean, he always tweets about being like the Yak King, and he doesn't really have that sort of, you know, ability in the open field that he once had, but he's, you know, he's a reliable guy. Like I said, it doesn't look like he's ever open, but he somehow makes catches, and he just has sort of that, sort of savvy, and he's just kind of an athlete. He just makes plays, but he's not a big part of the offense. Shepard's back, so I actually think with McCoy in there, they might use him more, because again, I don't think McCoy will be airing it out. So if you're looking for a guy to move the chains, I mean, that is sort of what Golden Tate does. So maybe he does have a bigger role against the Seahawks than he's had to this point.
Did Golden ever speak after the game against the Rams? But, you know, when he had the beef with him and Jalen Ramsey again, if you listen to the show now, just go ahead and Google that. We don't have time to dig into to the history there. But yeah, did
there's
he?
There's a lot there.
Yeah, there is a lot.
He actually did speak that week, and you know, I think on that one, he didn't get, you know, it sounds like a ton of school kids. He didn't get in trouble for that one because apparently Ramsey really was the instigator and the aggressor there. So I mean, if a guy swings at you, you know, what are you gonna do? So. You know, there was obviously some drama with them leading into that, but as far as what happened after the game, it doesn't really feel like Tate did anything wrong. So he, you know, he spoke, but definitely did the kind of typical, you know, we're moving forward type of deal, and didn't really dwell on it, didn't really go down that road too much. But so that was just sort of a blip on the radar, because I don't really think he was necessarily at fault for how that all went down.
I want to flip to the defensive side. And the Giants have a solid run game. They're fifth in the NFL with rushing yards allowed. How do you see this rush defense faring against the duo of Chris Carson and Carlos Hyde, considering Seahawks just got back Chris Carson? He looks to be 100%.
Well, I mean, for them to have a chance, it has to basically shut them down. Because again, I think the pass problem, the pass and passing offense of Seattle poses a much bigger problem. So, I mean, that's the strength of their defense. They have a lot invested there. I mean, Leonard Williams is playing on the franchise tag. Dexter Lawrence is a former first round pick. Dalvin Tomlinson, the former second round pick. I mean, they have some talent up there. It's probably the one position group they actually have some pretty solid talent across the board. And then even Blake Martinez, an inside linebacker, he's one of the highest paid inside linebackers, and he's really strong against the run. So, you know, I don't know that they're going to shut down Seattle's rushing attack, but if they don't, it's in huge trouble because they need to, you know, stop the run and, you know, force them into obvious passing situations where, you know, Patrick Graham can get creative with his coverages and find a way to, you know, get some sort of pressure on Wilson. But they really haven't, like you said, I mean, they're fifth in the league. I mean, they haven't been run on very much at all this year. Those guys up front are pretty stout. So I would be surprised if Seattle gashes them. But again, if for the Giants have any chance, they need to really kind of shut that down. But like they have done in most games this season.
You know, it's very rare we talk about a player who isn't on, you know, the opposing team anymore. But in this instance, I feel like we have to talk about DeAndre Baker, even if only for a little bit here, because I think I tweeted once. I was like, there was like at least 17 different moments when I thought Quentin Dunbar would never suit up for the Seahawks. It might have been after he got an interception. And I don't think DeAndre has suited up for the Chiefs yet this year, but he could. Like, how many different times were you like, yo, DeAndre's A, never going to play for the Giants, and B, DeAndre's probably going to go to prison?
Yeah, that was a wild one. I mean, I know we were, you know, talking in Slack back when everything kind of first dropped. I think it was in May. That was pretty wild. You know, that first affidavit that came out was like, whoa, it was like out of a movie or something. And yeah, it was strange. I mean, because with Dunbar, it feels like either he had a better agent or a lawyer or like a much worse one, because his lawyer ended up getting like disbarred, but he was the one who got kind of off scot-free and was back playing. And meanwhile, Baker was really tied up in the whole legal process. And I, you know, of course, everything got dropped. We certainly don't have time to relive every twist and turn of that.
No, we do not.
Seriously, be a Law and Order series. It would be like one episode. But I mean, as far as with the Giants, I knew right, like pretty early, you know, that he was not going to be back here. Because the thing with him is, he didn't have a very distinguished rookie year on the field or in the locker room. I'm not talking off the field in terms of legal stuff. I mean, he played very poorly, wasn't very committed. You know, was not a professional. And like, he wasn't thought very highly of in the building. Even in the off season, it's a virtual program. Granted, it's voluntary. He wasn't even going to, you know, tuning into all those Zoom calls. I mean, it's a new staff. You think you may want to put your best foot forward. So there was a lot of baggage there. Then when this happened, I mean, listen, we'll never know what happened. You know, I think we all know something happened, but, you know, no one can figure out exactly what happened. It's just obviously quite a messy situation. But I just think the Giants, you know, looked at the situation and just said, you know, no thanks. We're fine with moving on. So that's a tough thing to do with, the first round pick. They just made, you know, a big investment in. And then with landing with the Chiefs, I mean, listen, that's the way the NFL is. I mean, you know, once the Chargers get dropped, it's, you know, someone else, it's not really their problem. The Giants kind of endured all the bad headlines. The Chiefs sneak them on the practice squad. No one really probably even raises an eyebrow very much. And then, yeah, who knows? Maybe he ends up, you know, getting on the field and playing for them on the Super Bowl run. So can't say it worked out well for DeAndre Baker because, you know, he basically lost a season and his reputation got dragged through the mud. And I'm sure he lost some money in the process. But it might turn out pretty well because he landed in a pretty good spot.
Huh, he wasn't showing up to the Zoom meeting, so I wonder if he was busy playing video games with some homies at some at some house party. Or was it cards? Or was it both?
It was cards for sure. I know that. I don't remember if it was video games, but I do know it was cards.
Man, we might have to do something about that. Maybe like a year from now or something.
Yeah.
Just because that was just the wildest thing between the watches and the money and the bribery and Quentin's lawyer being. I googled Quentin's lawyer like after he, you know, was taken off the case, and I was like, oh my god. This is the shadiest dude Quentin could have possibly hired.
Yeah, there was a lot of characters in this one. So yeah, it's like I said, that'd be a whole like Law and Order podcast because there's a lot of twists and turns of that story.
Well, when he got when he was like a free agent and everything was like, all right, cool, he's dropped. People were tweeting me like, oh, maybe the Seahawks should sign. I was like, I don't think Quentin and DeAndre should hang out anymore. I just don't, you know, that's just, it's not even a football thing. I honestly didn't watch DeAndre play one snap last year. Like, because that's the Giants aren't my bag. But I was like, you know, just from what I can tell, if nothing else, they were in a very bad place when everyone's supposed to be quarantining. The last place you should be is at the party with the homies. So, yeah, I'm glad the Chiefs kind of snatched that up real quick.
Before we get you out of here, we do have to do an over and under. And it sounds as if Colt McCoy will be starting because, unfortunately, Daniel Jones has a hamstring injury. And do you like Drake, Dan?
Yeah, I can't say I'm like the biggest Drake guy, but what do you got for me?
Do you remember the song Forever in 2009?
No.
You're okay. Basically, Drake said, like a sprained ankle, boy, I ain't nothing to play with. And I think Drake should change that line. Like a strained hamstring, boy, I ain't nothing to play with. Because, I mean, when you think about it, hamstrings are vital. You can't run without them. But on a serious note, we're going to go Colt McCoy over or under. I'm going to say 1.5 interceptions. Over or under on that?
Ooh, I'll take over. I think probably 2. I mean, I don't think that, like I said, I don't think he's slinging it around, but I could see 2 interceptions pretty easily.
I am not mad at that.
What was the over-under last week? It was Carson Wentz, 1.5 turnovers?
Yep, and he only had 1. Went with the under, so that was right. And then I had the DK Metcalf, Darius Slay one. Well, that didn't work out.
Well, it didn't work out for Slay. That was bad.
Yeah, he went under 115.5 yards, and DK destroyed that with 10 catches and 177 yards.
Jesus Christ, that's bad. All right, well, Dan, we got to get you out of here. One last thing. We need a prediction from you. Give us a score. What you got?
All right, so operating under the impression that no Daniel Jones. I just talked about how they've kept every game close, but I think this one is like 31-13. I kind of can see Seattle beating up on them. I just think that passing offense is going to be a problem, and I just don't have a lot of faith in the Colt McCoy-led offense to keep up.
No faith in Colt McCoy, huh? That's funny. That's so wild to me that he's still in the league. It's just I was looking at his numbers before we had you on, and I was like, how is he still around? Like, he's just never been really, really good. But, you know, good for Colt. Whatever. It's all right. Dan, real quick, are you verified on Twitter?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you are, huh? Well, so that's just only you, Chris. That's not. Where can people follow you on Twitter, Dan?
DDuggan21.
All right, make sure you guys go check out his work. Covers the Giants for The Athletic. Does some great stuff. He was on the DeAndre Baker beat for months there. And I know you guys don't necessarily maybe care about how tough our jobs get, but it's something when you're trying to enjoy your summer and then you're just like, oh, no, this cornerback that I covered just might have robbed some folks. Oh, maybe he bribed some folks too. Oh, maybe he did both. I don't know. Let me end my night to go hop on that. So, kudos for all that work, Dan. Make sure you guys go check out his stuff. We appreciate you guys tuning in to another episode of the Seahawks Man to Man podcast, powered by The Athletic. Once again, shout out to the company. We will catch you guys on Sunday after, what is that? Seahawks going to beat the Giants 31-13. We have it right there.